This is Audible.
The Cider House Rules, a novel by John Irving. Copyright 1985 by Garp Enterprises Limited. This recording of the reading of The Cider House Rules was published by arrangement with Garp Enterprises Limited and was produced in 1985 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Dedication for David Colicchio. Conventionality is not morality. Self-righteousness is not religion. To attack the first is not to assail the last. Charlotte Bronte, 1847. For practical purposes, abortion may be defined as the interruption of gestation before viability of the child. H. J. Bolt, M.D., 1906. Chapter 1. The Boy Who Belonged to St. Clouds. In the hospital of the orphanage, the boys' division at St. Clouds, Maine, two nurses were in charge of naming the new babies and checking that their little penises were healing from the obligatory circumcision. In those days, in 1920-something, all boys born at St. Clouds were circumcised because the orphanage physician had experienced some difficulty in treating uncircumcised soldiers for this and for that in World War I. The doctor, who was also the director of the boys' division, was not a religious man. Circumcision was not a rite with him. It was a strictly medical act, performed for hygienic reasons. His name was Wilbur Larch, which, except for the scent of ether that always accompanied him, reminded one of the nurses of the tough, durable wood of the coniferous tree of that name. She hated, however, the ridiculous name of Wilbur, and took offense at the silliness of combining a word like Wilbur with something as substantial as a tree. The other nurse imagined herself to be in love with Dr. Larch, and when it was her turn to name a baby, she frequently named him John Larch or John Wilbur. Her father's name was John. Or Wilbur Walsh. Her mother's maiden name had been Walsh. Despite her love for Dr. Larch, she could not imagine Larch as anything but a last name. And when she thought of him, she did not think of trees at all. For its flexibility as a first or as a last name, she loved the name of Wilbur. And when she tired of her use of John or was criticized by her colleague for overusing it, she could rarely come up with anything more original than a Robert Larch or a Jack Wilbur. She seemed not to know that Jack was often a nickname for John. If he had been named by this dull, love-struck nurse, he probably would have been a Larch or a Wilbur of one kind or another, and a John, a Jack, or a Robert, to make matters even duller. Because it was the other nurse's turn, he was named Homer Wells. The other nurse's father was in the business of drilling wells, which was hard, harrowing, honest, precise work. To her thinking, her father was composed of these qualities, which lent the word Wells a certain deep, down-to-earth aura. Homer had been the name of one of her family's umpteen cats. This other nurse, Nurse Angela, to almost everyone, rarely repeated the names of her babies, whereas poor Nurse Edna had named three John Wilbur Juniors and two John Larch the Thirds. Nurse Angela knew an inexhaustible number of no-nonsense nouns, which she diligently employed as last names. Maple, Fields, Stone, Hill, Knot, Day, Waters, to list a few, and a slightly less impressive list of first names borrowed from a family history of many dead but cherished pets. Felix, Fuzzy, Smokey, Sam, Snowy, Joe, Curly, Ed, and so forth. For most of the orphans, of course, these nurse-given names were temporary. The boys' division had a better record than the girls' division at placing the orphans in homes when they were babies, too young ever to know the names their good nurses had given them. Most of the orphans wouldn't even remember Nurse Angela or Nurse Edna, the first women in the world to fuss over them. Dr. Larch made it a firm policy that the orphans' adoptive families not be informed of the names the nurses gave with such zeal. The feeling at St. Cloud's was that a child, upon leaving the orphanage, should know the thrill of a fresh start. But, especially with the boys who were difficult to place and lived at St. Cloud's the longest, it was hard for Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna, and even for Dr. Larch, not to think of their John Wilbers and John Larches, their Felix Hills, Curly Maples, Joe Knotts, Smokey Waterses, as possessing their nurse-given names forever. The reason Homer Wells kept his name was that he came back to St. Cloud's so many times, after so many failed foster homes, that the orphanage was forced to acknowledge Homer's intention to make St. Cloud's his home. It was not easy for anyone to accept, but Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna, and finally Dr. Wilbur Larch, were forced to admit that Homer Wells belonged to St. Cloud's. The determined boy was not put up for adoption anymore. Nurse Angela, with her love of cats and orphans, once remarked of Homer Wells that the boy must adore the name she gave him because he fought so hard not to lose it. St. Cloud's, Maine, the town, had been a logging camp for most of the 19th century. The camp, and gradually the town, set up shop in the river valley where the land was flat, which made the first roads easier to build and the heavy equipment easier to transport. The first building was a sawmill. The first settlers were French Canadians, woodsmen, lumberjacks, sawyers. Then came the overland haulers and the river bargemen, then the prostitutes, then the vagrants and the thugs, and, at last, there was a church. The first logging camp had been called simply Clouds, because the valley was low and the clouds broke up reluctantly. A fog hung over the violent river until mid-morning, and the falls, which roared for 3 miles upstream from the site of the first camp, produced a constant mist. When the first woodcutters went to work there, the only impediments to their rape of the forest were the black flies and the mosquitoes. These infernal insects preferred the nearly constant cover of clouds in the stagnant valleys of inland Maine to the sharp air of the mountains, or to the crisp sunlight by the bright Maine sea. Dr. Wilbur Larch, who was not only the doctor for the orphanage and the director of the boys' division, he had also founded the place, was the self-appointed historian of the town. According to Dr. Larch, the logging camp called Clouds became St. Cloud's only because of the fervent backwoods Catholic instinct to put a saint before so many things, as if to grant those things a grace they could never quite acquire naturally. The logging camp remained St. Cloud's for nearly half a century before the apostrophe was inserted, probably by someone who was unaware of the camp's origin. But by the time it became St. Cloud's, apostrophe S, it was more of a mill town than a logging camp. The forest, for miles around, was cleared. Instead of logs jamming the river and the rough camp full of men lamed and crippled by falling from trees or by trees falling on them, one saw the high, orderly stacks of fresh-cut boards drying out in the hazy sun. Over all lay a silty sawdust, occasionally too fine to see, but ever present in the sneezes and wheezes of the town, in the town's perpetually itching noses and in its rasping lungs. The town's wounded now sported stitches instead of bruises and broken bones. They wore gashes and found ways to flaunt their missing parts from the mill's many saws. The keen whine of those blades was as constant in St. Cloud's as the fog, the mist, the humidity that overhangs inland Maine in the damp cold of its long, wet, snowed-in winters, and in the fetid, stifling heat of its drizzly summers, blessed only occasionally by violent thunderstorms. There was never any spring in that part of Maine, except that period of time in March and April distinguished by thawing mud. The heavy equipment of the lumbering business was immobilized, the work of the town shut down. The impassable roads kept everyone at home, and the springtime river was so swollen and ran so fast that no one dared to travel on it. Spring in St. Cloud's meant trouble, drinking trouble, brawling trouble, whoring and raping trouble. Spring was the suicide season. In spring, the seeds for an orphanage were planted and overplanted. And what of the fall? In his journal, his what-not diary, his daily record of the business of the orphanage, Dr. Wilbur Larch wrote of the fall. Each of Dr. Larch's entries began, "Here in St. Cloud's," except for those entries that began, "In other parts of the world." Of the fall, Dr. Larch wrote, "In other parts of the world, fall is for the harvest. One gathers the fruits of spring and summer's labors. These fruits provide for the long slumber and the season of ungrowing that is called winter. But here in St. Cloud's, the fall is only 5 minutes long." What sort of climate would anyone expect for an orphanage? Could anyone imagine resort weather? Would an orphanage bloom in an innocent town? In his journal, Dr. Larch was demonstratively conservative with paper. He wrote in a small, cramped hand on both sides of the pages, which were absolutely filled. Dr. Larch was not a man for leaving margins. "Here in St. Cloud's," he wrote, "guess who is the enemy of the main forests, the villainous father of the unwanted babies, the reason the river is choked with deadwood and the valley land stripped, unplanted, eroded by the river floods? Guess who is the insatiable destroyer, first of a logger with his hands pitchy and his fingers mashed, then of a lumberman, a sawmill slave whose hands are dry and cracked, with some fingers only a memory? And guess why this glutton is not satisfied with logs or with lumber? Guess who?" To Dr. Larch, the enemy was paper. Specifically, the Ramsey's Paper Company. There were enough trees for lumber, Dr. Larch imagined, but there would never be enough trees for all the paper the Ramsey's Paper Company seemed to want or to need, especially if one failed to plant new trees. When the valley surrounding St. Cloud's was cleared, and the second growth, scrub pine and random, unmanaged softwoods, sprang up everywhere like swamp weed, and when there were no more logs to send down river from Three Mile Falls to St. Cloud's, because there were no more trees, that was when the Ramsey's Paper Company introduced Maine to the 20th century by closing down the sawmill and the lumber yard along the river at St. Cloud's and moving camp downstream. And what was left behind? The weather, the sawdust, the scarred, bruised bank of the river, where the big log drives, jamming, had gouged out a raw new shore, and the buildings themselves, the mill with its broken windows with no screens, the Hoare Hotel with its dance hall downstairs and the bingo for money room overlooking the rough river, the few private homes, log cabin style, and the church, which was Catholic for the French Canadians, which looked too clean and unused to belong to St. Cloud's, where it had never been half as popular as the Hoare's or the dance hall or even bingo for money. In Dr. Larch's journal, he wrote, "In other parts of the world, they play tennis or poker, but here in St. Cloud's, they play bingo for money." And the people who were left behind? There were no Ramsey's Paper Company people left behind, but there were people, the older and the less attractive prostitutes, and the children of these prostitutes. Not one of the neglected officers of the Catholic Church of St. Cloud's stayed. There were more souls to save by following the Ramsey's Paper Company downstream. In his A Brief History of St. Cloud's, Dr. Larch documented that at least one of these prostitutes knew how to read and write. On the last barge downriver, following the Ramsey's Paper Company to a new civilization, a relatively literate prostitute sent a letter addressed to "Whichever official of the state of Maine who is concerned with orphans." Somehow this letter actually reached someone. Forwarded many times, for its curiosity, Dr. Larch wrote, as much as for its urgency. The letter was delivered to the State Board of Medical Examiners. The youngest member of this board, a puppy right out of medical school, as Dr. Larch described himself, was shown the prostitute's letter as a kind of bait. The rest of the board thought that young Larch was the one hopelessly naive Democrat and liberal among them. The letter said, "There should be a goddamned doctor and a goddamned school and even a goddamned policeman and a goddamned lawyer in St. Cloud's, which has been deserted by its goddamn men, who were never much, and left to helpless women and orphans." The chairman of the State Board of Medical Examiners was a retired physician who thought that President Teddy Roosevelt was the only other man in the world besides himself who had not been made from a banana. "Why don't you look into this mush, Larch?" the chairman said, little knowing that out of this invitation a state-supported facility for orphans would soon develop. It would one day gain at least partial federal support, and even that most vague and least dependable support offered by private benefactors. Anyway, in 19-aught-something, as the 20th century, so young and full of promise, blossomed, even in inland Maine, Dr. Wilbur Larch undertook the task of righting the wrongs of St. Cloud's. He had his work cut out for him. For almost 20 years, Dr. Larch would leave St. Cloud's only once, for World War I, where it is doubtful he was more needed. What better man could be imagined for the job of undoing what the Ramsey's Paper Company had done than a man named after one of the world's coniferous trees. In his journal, as he was only beginning, Dr. Larch wrote, "Here in St. Clouds, it is high time something was done for the good of someone. What better place for improvement could there be, for self-improvement and for the good of all, than a place where evil has so clearly flourished, if not altogether triumphed?" In 1920-something, when Homer Wells was born and had his little penis snipped and was named, Nurse Edna, who was in love, and Nurse Angela, who wasn't, had in common a pet name of their own for St. Cloud's founder, physician, town historian, war hero, he was even decorated, and director of the boys' division. St. Larch, they called him. And why not? When Wilbur Larch granted Homer Wells permission to remain at St. Cloud's for as long as the boy felt he belonged there, the doctor was merely exercising his considerable and earned authority. On the issue of belonging to St. Cloud's, Dr. Larch was an authority. St. Larch had found his place, in the 20th century, to be, as he put it, of use. And that is precisely how Dr. Larch instructed Homer Wells, when the doctor sternly accepted the boy's need to stay at St. Cloud's. "Well then, Homer," said St. Larch, "I expect you to be of use." He was nothing, Homer Wells, if not of use. His sense of usefulness appears to predate Dr. Larch's instructions. His first foster parents returned him to St. Cloud's. They thought there was something wrong with him. He never cried. The foster parents complained that they would wake up to the same silence that had prompted them to adopt a child in the first place. They'd wake up alarmed that the baby hadn't woken them. They'd rush into the baby's room, expecting to find him dead. But Homer Wells would be toothlessly biting his lip, perhaps grimacing, but not protesting that he was unfed or unattended. Homer's foster parents always suspected that he'd been awake, quietly suffering, for hours. They thought this wasn't normal. Dr. Larch explained to them that the babies of St. Cloud's were used to lying in their beds unattended. Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna, dearly devoted though they were, could not be rushing to each and every baby the second it cried. Crying was not of much use at St. Cloud's. Though in his heart of hearts, Dr. Larch knew very well that Homer's capacity for withholding tears was unusual, even for an orphan. It was Dr. Larch's experience that foster parents who could so easily be deterred from wanting a baby were not the best parents for an orphan. Homer's first foster parents were so quick to assume they'd been given a wrong one, retarded, a lemon, brain-damaged, that Dr. Larch didn't extend himself to assure them that Homer was a very fit baby, bound to have a courageous long haul in the life ahead. His second foster family responded differently to Homer's lack of sound, his stiff upper lip and bite the bullet while just lying there placidity. His second foster family beat the baby so regularly that they managed to get some appropriately baby-like noise out of him. Homer's crying saved him. If he'd proven himself to be stalwart at resisting tears, now when he saw the tears and howls and shrieks seemed to be what his foster family most desired of him, he tried to be of use and gave, with his whole heart, the lustiest wails he could deliver. He had been such a creature of contentment, Dr. Larch was surprised to learn that the new baby from St. Cloud's was disturbing the peace in the fortunately small and nearby town of Three Mile Falls. It's fortunate that Three Mile Falls was small, because the stories of Homer's cries were the center of the area's gossip for several weeks. And it's fortunate that Three Mile Falls was nearby, because the stories found their way to St. Cloud's and to Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna, who had cornered the gossip market in all those river, wood, and paper towns. When they heard the tales of how their Homer Wells was keeping Three Mile Falls awake until the small hours, and how he would wake up the town before it was light, the nurse's good memories did not forsake them. They went straight to St. Larch. "That's not my Homer," Nurse Angela cried. "He's not a natural at crying, Wilbur," Nurse Edna said, taking every opportunity she had to pronounce that name so dear to her heart, Wilbur. It always made Nurse Angela cross with her, whenever Nurse Edna indulged her desire to call Dr. Larch a Wilbur to his face. "Dr. Larch," Nurse Angela said, with pointed and excessive formality, If Homer Wells is waking up Three Mile Falls, that family you let have him must be burning that boy with their cigarettes. They weren't that kind of family. That was a favorite fantasy of Nurse Angela's. She hated smoking. Just the look of a cigarette dangling from anyone's mouth made her remember a French-speaking Indian who'd come to see her father about digging a well and had stuck his cigarette in one of her cat's faces, burning its nose. The cat, an especially friendly spayed female, had jumped up in the Indian's lap. That cat had been named Bandit. She'd had the classic masked face of a raccoon. Nurse Angela had restrained herself from naming any of the orphans after Bandit. She thought of Bandit as a girl's name. But the family from Three Mile Falls were not sadists of a very known kind. An older man and his younger wife lived with his grown-up children of a previous marriage. The young wife wanted a child of her own, but she couldn't get pregnant. Everyone in the family thought it would be nice for the young wife to have her own baby. What no one mentioned was that one of the grown-up children from the previous marriage had had a baby illegitimately, and she hadn't cared for it very well, and the baby had cried and cried and cried. Everyone complained about the baby crying night and day, and one morning the grown-up daughter had simply taken her baby and gone. She'd left only this note behind. "I'm sick of hearing from all of you about how much my baby cries. I guess if I go, you won't miss the crying or me either." But they did miss the crying. Everyone missed that wonderful, bawling baby and the dear, dim-witted daughter who had taken it away. "Be sure nice to have a baby crying around here again," someone in the family had remarked, and so they went and got themselves a baby from St. Cloud's. They were the wrong family to be given a baby who wouldn't cry. Homer's silence was such a disappointment to them that they took it as a kind of affront and challenged each other to discover who among them could make the baby cry first. After first, they progressed to loudest. After loudest came longest. They first made him cry by not feeding him, but they made him cry loudest by hurting him. This usually meant pinching him or punching him. But there was ample evidence that the baby had been bitten, too. They made him cry longest by frightening him. They discovered that startling babies was the best way to frighten them. They must have been very accomplished at achieving the loudest and longest in order to have made Homer Wells's crying a legend in Three Mile Falls. It was especially hard to hear anything in Three Mile Falls, not to mention how hard it was to make a legend out of anything there. The falls themselves made such a steady roar that Three Mile Falls was the perfect town for murder. No one there could hear a shot or a scream. If you murdered someone in Three Mile Falls and threw the body in the river at the falls, the body couldn't possibly be stopped, or even slowed down, not to mention found, until it went 3 miles downriver to St. Cloud's. It was therefore all the more remarkable that the whole town heard the kind of crying Homer Wells made. It took Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna about a year before Homer Wells stopped waking up with a scream or letting out a wail whenever someone crossed his field of vision, or whenever he heard a human sound, or even a chair being dragged across the floor, or even a bed creak, a window shut, a door open. Every sight and sound connected with a human being who might possibly be headed in Homer's direction produced a high, stammering shout and such tearful blubbering that anyone visiting the boys' division would have thought that the orphanage was, in fairy-tale fashion, a torture shop, a prison of child molestation and abuse beyond imagining. "Homer, Homer," Dr. Larch would say soothingly, while the boy burned scarlet and filled his lungs. "Homer, you're going to get us investigated for murder. You're going to get us shut down." Poor Nurse Edna and poor Nurse Angela were probably more permanently scarred by the family from Three Mile Falls than Homer Wells was, and the good and the great St. Larch never fully recovered from the incident. He had met the family, he'd interviewed them all, and been horribly wrong about them. And he'd seen them all again on the day he went to 3 Mile Falls to bring Homer Wells back to St. Cloud's. What Dr. Larch would always remember was the fright in all of their expressions when he'd marched into their house and taken Homer up in his arms. The fear in their faces would haunt Dr. Larch forever, the epitome of everything he could never understand about the great ambiguity in the feelings people had for children. There was the human body, which was so clearly designed to want babies, and then there was the human mind, which was so confused about the matter. Sometimes the mind didn't want the babies, but sometimes the mind was so perverse that it made other people have babies they knew they didn't want. For whom was this insisting done? Dr. Large wondered. For whom did some minds insist that babies, even clearly unwanted ones, must be brought screaming into the world? And when other minds thought they wanted babies but then couldn't or wouldn't take proper care of them, well, what were these minds thinking? When Dr. Larch's mind ran away with him on the subject, it was always the fear in those faces of the family from Three Mile Falls that he saw, and Homer Wells's legendary howl that he heard. The fear in that family was fixed in St. Larch's vision. No one, he believed, who had ever seen such fear should ever make a woman have a baby she didn't want to have. No one, Dr. Larch wrote in his journal. Not even someone from the Ramsey's Paper Company. If you had an ounce of sanity, you would not speak against abortion to Dr. Wilbur Larch, or you would suffer every detail there was to know about the 6 weeks Homer Wells spent with the family from Three Mile Falls. This was Larch's only way of discussing the issue, which was not even open to debate with him. He was an obstetrician, but when he was asked, and when it was safe, he was an abortionist, too. By the time Homer was 4, he didn't have those dreams anymore, the ones that could awaken every living soul in St. Cloud's, the dreams that caused one night watchman to resign. "My heart," he said, "won't take another night of that boy." And that resided so soundly in the memory of Dr. Wilbur Larch that he was known for years to hear babies crying in his sleep and to roll over saying, "Homer, Homer, it's all right now, Homer." At St. Cloud's, of course, babies were always crying in everyone's sleep, but no baby ever woke up crying in quite the manner that Homer Wells managed it. "Lord, it's as if he's being stabbed," Nurse Edna would say. "As if he was being burned with a cigarette," Nurse Angela would say. But only Wilbur Larch knew what it was really like, that way that Homer Wells woke up and, in his violent waking, woke everyone else. "As if he were being circumcised," Dr. Larch wrote in his journal, "as if someone were snipping his little penis, over and over again, just snipping it and snipping it." The third foster family to fail with Homer Wells was a family of such rare and championship qualities that to judge humanity by this family's example would be foolish. They were that good a family. They were that perfect, or Dr. Larch would not have let Homer go to them. After the family from Three Mile Falls, Dr. Larch was being especially careful with Homer. Professor Draper and his wife of nearly 40 years lived in Waterville, Maine. Waterville was not much of a college town in 1930-something, when Homer Wells went there. But if you compared Waterville to St. Cloud's or to Three Mile Falls, you would have to say that Waterville was a community of moral and social giants. Though still inland, it was of considerably higher elevation. There were nearby mountains, and from these there were actual vistas. Mountain life, like the life on an ocean or on the plains or an open farmland, affords the inhabitant the luxury of a view. Living on land where you can occasionally see a long way provides the soul with a perspective of a beneficially expansive nature. Or so believed Professor Draper. He was a born teacher. "Unfarmed valley land," he would intone, "which I associate with forests too low and too dense to provide a view, tends to cramp the uplifting qualities of human nature and enhance those instincts which are mean-spirited and small." "Now, Homer," Mrs. Draper would say, "the professor is a born teacher. You have to take him with a grain of salt." Everyone called her Mom. No one, including his grown children and his grandchildren, called him anything but Professor. Even Dr. Larch didn't know what his first name was. If his tone was professorial, at times even officious, he was a man of very regular habits and temperament, and his manner was jocular. "Wet shoes," the professor once said to Homer, "are a fact of Maine. They are a given. Your method, Homer, of putting wet shoes on a windowsill where they might be dried by the faint appearance, albeit rare, of the Maine sun, is admirable for its positivism, its determined optimism. However, the professor would go on, a method I would recommend for wet shoes, a method I must add that is independent of the weather, involves a more reliable source of heat in Maine, namely, the furnace. When you consider that the days when shoes get wet are days, as a rule, when we don't see the sun, you'll recognize the furnace room method as having certain advantages. With a grain of salt, Homer, Mrs. Draper would tell the boy. Even the professor called her Mom. Even Mom called him Professor. If Homer Wells found the professor's conversation abounding in pithy maxims, he didn't complain. If Professor Draper's students at the college and his colleagues in the history department thought that the professor was a sententious bore, and tended to flee his path like rabbits escaping the slow but nose-to-ground hound, they could not influence Homer's opinion of the first father figure in his life to rival Dr. Large. Homer's arrival in Waterville was greeted by the kind of attention the boy had never known. Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna were emergency providers, and Dr. Larch was an affectionate, if stern and distracted, overseer. But Mrs. Draper was a mom's mom. She was a hoverer. She was up before Homer was awake. The cookies she baked while he ate his breakfast were miraculously still warm in his lunch bag at noon. Mom Draper hiked to school with Homer. They went overland, disdaining the road. It was her constitutional, she said. In the afternoons, Professor Draper met Homer in the school's playground. School's end seemed magically timed to coincide with the professor's last class of the day at the college, and they would tramp home together. In the winter, which in Waterville came early, this was a literal tramping, in snowshoes, the mastery of which the professor placed on a level of learning to read and write. "Use the body, use the mind, Homer," the professor said. It's easy to see why Wilbur Larch was impressed with the man. He vigorously represented usefulness. In truth, Homer liked the routine of it, the tramp-tramp of it, the utter predictability of it. An orphan is simply more of a child than other children in that essential appreciation of the things that happen daily, on schedule. For everything that promises to last, to stay the same, the orphan is a sucker. Dr. Larch ran the boys' division with as many of the simulated manifestations of daily life as are possible to cultivate at an orphanage. Meals were promptly served at the same time every day. Dr. Larch would read aloud at the same evening hour for the same length of time, even if it meant leaving a chapter in mid-adventure, with the boys shouting, "More! More! Just read the next thing that happens!" And St. Larch would say, "Tomorrow, same time, same place." There would be groans of disappointment, but Larch knew that he had made a promise. He had established a routine. "Here in St. Cloud's," he wrote in his journal, "security is measured by the number of promises kept. Every child understands a promise, if it is kept, and looks forward to the next promise. Among orphans, you build security slowly but regularly." Slow but regular would describe the life that Homer Wells led with the Drapers in Waterville. Every activity was a lesson. Each corner of the comfortable old house held something to be learned and then counted upon. "This is Rufus. He's very old," the professor would say, introducing Homer to the dog. "This is Rufus's rug. This is his kingdom. When Rufus is sleeping on his kingdom, do not wake him unless you are prepared for him to snap." Whereupon the professor would rouse the ancient dog, who would snap awake, and then appear to puzzle over the air he had bitten, tasting in it the Draper's grown-up children, now married and with children of their own. Homer met them all for Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving with the Drapers was an experience in family guaranteed to make other families feel inferior. Mom would outdo herself at momness. The professor had a lecture ready on every conceivable subject, the qualities of white meat and of dark, the last election, the pretension of salad forks, the superiority of the 19th-century novel, not to mention other aspects of that century's superiority, the proper texture of cranberry sauce, the meaning of repentance, the wholesomeness of exercise, including a comparison between splitting wood and ice skating, the evil inherent in naps, to each laboriously expressed opinion of the professor's, his grown children, two married women, one married man, would respond with a fairly balanced mixture of, "Just so. Isn't that always the way? Right again, Professor?" These robot-like responses were punctuated with equal precision by Mom's oft-repeated, "Grain of salt, grain of salt." Homer Wells listened to these steady rhythms like a visitor from another world trying to decipher a strange tribe's drums. He couldn't quite catch on. The seeming constancy of everyone was overwhelming. He wouldn't know until he was much older just what it was that didn't set well with him, the implicit and explicit and self-congratulatory do-gooderism, or the heartiness with which life was tediously oversimplified. Whichever it was, he stopped liking it. It became an obstacle in the path that he was looking for that led to himself, to who he was or should be. He remembered various Thanksgivings at St. Cloud's. They were not so cheery as the Waterville Thanksgiving with the Draper family, but they seemed a lot more real. He remembered how he had felt of use. There were always babies who couldn't feed themselves. There was the likelihood of a snowstorm that would knock out the electricity. Homer was put in charge of the candles and the kerosene lamps. He was also in charge of helping the kitchen staff clear, of helping Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna comfort the crying, of being Dr. Larch's messenger, the most prized responsibility that was conferred in the boys' division. Before he was 10, and long before he would be given such explicit instruction from Dr. Larch, Homer felt full of usefulness at St. Cloud's. What was it about Thanksgiving at the Drapers that contrasted so severely with the same event at St. Cloud's? Mom had no match as a cook. It couldn't have been the food, which at St. Cloud's suffered from a visible and seemingly terminal grayness. Was it the saying of grace? At St. Cloud's, grace was a rather blunt instrument, Dr. Larch not being a religious man. "Let us be thankful," he would say, and then pause, as if he were truly wondering, what for? "Let us be thankful for what kindness we have received," Larch would say, cautiously looking at the unwanted and abandoned around him. "Let us be thankful for Nurse Angela and for Nurse Edna," he would add, with more assurance in his voice. "Let us be thankful that we've got options, that we've got second chances," he added once, looking at Homer Wells. The event of grace at Thanksgiving at St. Cloud's was shrouded with chance, with understandable caution, with typical Larch-like reserve. Grace at the Drapers was effusive and strange. It seemed somehow connected with the professor's definition of the meaning of repentance. Professor Draper said that the start of real repentance was to accept yourself as vile. For grace, the professor cried out, "Say after me, I am vile, I abhor myself, but I am thankful for everyone in my family." They all said so, even Homer, even Mom, who for once withheld her recommended grain of salt. St. Cloud's was a sober place, but its manner of giving what little thanks it could seemed frank, sincere. Some contradiction in the Draper family occurred to Homer Wells for the first time at Thanksgiving. Unlike St. Cloud's, life in Waterville seemed good. Babies, for example, were wanted. Where did repentance come from, then? Was there guilt attached to feeling lucky? And if Larch, as Homer had been told, was named from a tree, God, whom Homer heard a lot about in Waterville, seemed to be named from even tougher stuff, maybe from mountain, maybe from ice. If God was sobering in Waterville, the Draper Thanksgiving was, to Homer's surprise, a drunken occasion. The professor was, in Mom's words, in his cups. This, Homer deduced, meant that the professor had consumed more than his normal daily amount of alcohol, which, in Mom's words, made him only tipsy. Homer was shocked to see the two married daughters and the married son behave as if they were in their cups, too. And since Thanksgiving was special and he was allowed to stay up late, with all the grandchildren, Homer observed that nightly occurrence he had previously only heard as he was falling asleep. the thudding, dragging, shuffling sound, and the muffled voice of reason, which was the professor slurring his protest of the fact that Mom forcibly assisted him upstairs, and with astonishing strength lifted him to and deposited him upon the bed.
"Value of exercise!"
shouted the grown and married son, before toppling from the green chaise and collapsing upon the rug beside old Rufus, as if he'd been poisoned.
"Like father, like son," said one of the married daughters.
The other married daughter, Homer noted, had nothing to say. She slept peacefully in the rocking chair. Her whole hand, above the second knuckle joints, was submerged in her nearly full drink, which rested precariously in her lap. The unmanaged grandchildren violated the house's million rules. The professor's passionate readings of various riot acts were seemingly ignored for Thanksgiving. Homer Wells, not yet 10, crept quietly to his bed. Invoking an especially sad memory of St. Cloud's was a way he frequently forced sleep upon himself. What he remembered was the time he saw the mothers leaving the orphanage hospital, which was within view of the girls' division and which adjoined the boys' division. They were architecturally linked by a long shed, formerly a storage room for spare blades to the circular saw. It was early morning, but it was still dark out, and Homer needed the coach lights in order to see that it was snowing. He slept badly and was often awake for the arrival of the coach, which came from the railroad station and delivered to St. Cloud's the kitchen and cleaning staff and the first hospital shift. The coach was simply an abandoned railroad car. Set on sled runners in the winter, it was a converted sleigh pulled by horses. When there wasn't enough snow on the dirt road, the sled runners struck sparks against the stones in the ground and made a terrible grating noise. They were reluctant to change the runners for wheels until they knew the winter was over. A bright light like a flare sputtered by the heavily blanketed driver on the makeshift carriage seat. Softer lights winked inside the coach car. This morning, Homer noted, there were women waiting in the snow to be picked up by the coach. Homer Wells didn't recognize the women, who fidgeted the whole time it took the St. Cloud's staff to unload. There seemed to be a certain tension between these groups. The women waiting to board appeared shy, even ashamed. The men and women coming to work seemed, by comparison, arrogant, even superior, and one of them, it was a woman, made a rough remark to the women waiting to leave. Homer couldn't hear the remark, but its effect drove the waiting women away from the coach like a blast of the winter wind. The women who boarded the coach did not look back, or even at each other. They didn't even speak, and the driver, who struck Homer as a friendly man, who had something to say to nearly everyone in any weather, had no words for them. The coach simply turned around and glided across the snow to the station. In the lit windows, Homer Wells could see that several of the women had their faces in their hands, or sat as stonily as the other kind of mourner at a funeral, the one who must assume an attitude of total disinterest, or else risk total loss of control. He had never before seen the mothers who had their unwanted babies at St. Cloud's, and then left them there, and he didn't see them very clearly this time. It was unquestionably more meaningful that he first saw them as they were taking their leave, rather than arriving, full-bellied and undelivered of their problems. Importantly, Homer knew they did not look delivered of all their problems when they left. No one he had seen looked more miserable than those women. He suspected it was no accident that they left in darkness. When he tried to put himself to sleep, Thanksgiving night with the Drapers in Waterville, Homer Wells saw the mothers leaving in the snow. But he also saw more than he'd actually seen. On the nights he couldn't sleep, Homer rode in the coach to the station with the women. He boarded the train with them. He went to their homes with them. He singled out his mother and followed her. It was hard to see what she looked like and where she lived, where she'd come from, if she'd gone back there, and harder still to imagine who his father was and if she went back to him. Like most orphans, Homer Wells imagined that he saw his missing parents often, but he was always unrecognized by them. As a child, he was embarrassed to be caught staring at adults, sometimes affectionately, other times with an instinctual hostility he would not have recognized on his own face. "You stop it, Homer," Dr. Larch used to say to him at those times. "You just cut it out." As an adult, Homer Wells would still get caught staring. But on Thanksgiving night in Waterville, he stared so hard into his real parents' lives that he almost found them before he fell asleep, exhausted. He was abruptly awakened by one of the grandchildren, an older boy. Homer had forgotten he was going to share his bed with him because the house was crowded. "Move over," the boy said. Homer moved over. "Keep your pecker in your pajamas," the boy told Homer, who had no intention of taking it out. "You know what buggering is?" the boy asked then. "No," said Homer. "Yes, you do, peckerhead," the boy said. "That's what you all do at St. Cloud's. You bugger yourselves, all the time. I'm telling you, you try to bugger me and you'll go back there without your pecker," the boy said. "I'll cut off your pecker and feed it to the dog." "You mean Rufus?" Homer Wells asked. "That's right, peckerhead," the boy said. "You want to tell me again you don't know what buggering is?"
"I don't know," Homer said.
"You want me to show you, don't you?" the boy asked.
"I don't think so," Homer said.
"Yes, you do, peckerhead," the boy said. And he then tried to bugger Homer Wells. Homer had never seen or heard of anyone being so abused at St. Cloud's, although the older boy had learned his style of buggery at a private school, a very good one. He had never been educated in the kind of crying that Homer Wells had been taught by the family from Three Mile Falls. It seemed to Homer that it was a good time for crying loudly, if one wanted to escape the buggery, and his crying immediately awakened the one adult in the Draper household who had merely gone to sleep, as opposed to passing out. In other words, Homer woke Mom. He woke all the grandchildren, too, and since several of them were younger than Homer, and all of them had no knowledge of Homer's capacity for howls, his crying produced sheer terror among them, and even aroused Rufus, who snapped. "What in heaven's name?" Mom asked at Homer's door. "He tried to bugger me, so I let him have it," said the private school boy. Homer, who was struggling to get his legendary howls under control, to send them back to history, didn't know that grandchildren are believed before orphans. "Here in St. Cloud's," wrote Dr. Larch, "it is self-defeating and cruel to give much thought to ancestors. In other parts of the world, I'm sorry to say, an orphan's ancestors are always under suspicion." Mom hit Homer as hard as any representative of the failed family from Three Mile Falls ever hit him. She then banished him to the furnace room for the remainder of the night. It was at least warm and dry there, and there was a fold-out cot, which in the summers was used for camping trips. There were also lots of wet shoes, a pair of which even belonged to Homer. Some of the wet socks were almost dry and fit him. And the assortment of wet snowsuits and hardy tramping clothes gave Homer an adequate selection. He dressed himself in warm, outdoor clothes, which were for the most part nearly dry. He knew that Mom and the professor thought too highly of family ever to send him back to St. Cloud's over a mere buggery. If he wanted to go back, and he did, he'd have to leave on his own initiative. In fact, Mom had provided Homer with a vision of how his alleged buggery would be treated and doubtlessly cured. She'd made him kneel before the fold-out cot in the furnace room. "Say after me," she said, and repeated the professor's strange version of grace. "I am vile, I abhor myself," Mom said, and Homer had said it after her, knowing that every word was untrue. He'd never liked himself so much. He felt he was on the track to finding out who he was, how he could be of use. But he knew that the path led back to St. Cloud's. When Mom kissed him good night, she said, "Now, Homer, don't you mind what the professor has to say about this. Whatever he says, you just take it with a grain of salt." Homer Wells didn't wait to hear the text of the professor's lesson regarding buggery. Homer stepped outside. Even the snow didn't stop him. In Waterville, in 1930-something, it was no surprise to see so much snow on the ground for Thanksgiving. And Professor Draper had very carefully instructed Homer on the merits and methods of snowshoeing. Homer was a good tramper. He found the town road fairly easily, and the bigger road after that. It was daylight when the first truck stopped. It was a logging truck. This seemed, to Homer, appropriate to where he was going. "I belong to St. Cloud's," he told the driver. "I got lost." In 1930-something, every logger knew where St. Cloud's was. This driver knew it was in the other direction. "You're going the wrong way, kid," he advised the boy. "Turn around and look for a truck going the other way. What are you, from St. Cloud's?" the driver asked. Like most people, he assumed that orphans were always running away from the orphanage, not running to it. "I just belong there," Homer Wells said, and the driver waved goodbye. In Dr. Larch's opinion, this driver, in order to be so insensitive as to let a boy go off alone in the snow, simply had to be an employee of the Ramsey's Paper Company. The next driver was also driving a logging truck. It was empty, it was heading back to the forest for more logs, and St. Cloud's was more or less on the way. "You an orphan?" the driver asked Homer, when he said he was going to St. Cloud's. "No," Homer said, "I just belong there for now." In 1930-something, it took a long time to drive anywhere in Maine, especially with snow on the roads. It was growing dark when Homer Wells returned to his home. The quality of the light was the same as the early morning when he'd seen the mothers leaving their babies behind. Homer stood at the hospital entrance for a while and watched the snow fall. Then he went and stood at the entrance to the boys' division. Then he went back and stood outside the hospital entrance because there was better light there. He was still thinking of exactly what to say to Dr. Larch when the coach from the railroad station, that unmerry sleigh, stopped at the hospital entrance and let out a single passenger. She was so pregnant that the driver at first appeared concerned she might slip and fall. Then the driver appeared to realize why the woman had come here, and it must have struck him as immoral that he should actually help a woman like that through the snow. He drove off and left her making her careful way toward the entrance and toward Homer Wells. Homer rang the bell at the entrance for the woman, who didn't seem to know what to do. It occurred to him that she was hoping for a little time to think of what she, too, wanted to say to Dr. Larch. To anyone seeing them there, this was a mother with her son. There was just that kind of familiarity in the way they looked at each other, and in the clear recognition between them. They knew perfectly well what the other was up to. Homer was worried what Dr. Larch would say to him, but he realized that the woman was more worried than he was. The woman didn't know Dr. Larch. She had no idea what sort of place St. Cloud's was. More lights were turned on inside, and Homer recognized the divine shape of Nurse Angela coming to open the door. For some reason, he reached out and took the pregnant woman's hand. Maybe it was the tear frozen to her face that the new light had allowed him to see, but he wanted a hand to hold himself. He was calm, Homer Wells, as Nurse Angela peered into the snowy night in disbelief while she struggled to open the frozen door. To the pregnant woman and to her unwanted child, Homer said, "Don't worry. Everyone is nice here." He felt the pregnant woman squeeze his hand so hard that it hurt. The word "mother" was strangely on his lips when Nurse Angela finally got the door open and seized Homer Wells in her arms. "Oh, oh," she cried. "Oh, Homer! My Homer! Our Homer! I knew you'd be back!" And because the pregnant woman's hand still firmly held Homer's hand, neither one of them felt able to let go, Nurse Angela turned and included the woman in her embrace. It seemed to Nurse Angela that this pregnant woman was just another orphan who belonged, like Homer Wells, exactly where she was. What he told Dr. Larch was that he'd felt of no use in Waterville. Because of what the Drapers had said when they'd called Larch to say that Homer had run away, Homer had to explain about the buggery. Afterward, St. Larch explained all about buggery to Homer. The professor's drinking surprised Dr. Larch. He was good as a rule at detecting that. And the prayers baffled Larch. Dr. Larch's note to the Drapers was of a brevity the professor's own language rarely allowed. "Repent," the note said. Larch might have left it at that, but he couldn't resist adding, "You are vile. You should abhor yourselves." Wilbur Larch knew that a fourth foster family for Homer Wells would not be easy to find. The search took Dr. Larch 3 years, by which time Homer was 12, almost 13. Larch knew what the danger would be. It would take Homer a great many years to feel as comfortable anywhere else as he felt at St. Cloud's. "Here in St. Cloud's," Larch wrote in his journal, "we have only one problem. That there will always be orphans is not in the category of a problem. That is simply not to be solved. One does the best one can with that. One takes care of them. That our budget will always be too small is also not a problem. That won't be solved either. An orphanage goes down to the wire. By definition, that is what should happen. And it is not a problem that every woman who gets pregnant doesn't necessarily want her baby. Perhaps we can look ahead to a more enlightened time, when women will have the right to abort the birth of an unwanted child. But some women will always be uneducated, will always be confused, will always be frightened. Even in enlightened times, unwanted babies will manage to be born. And there will always be babies who were very much wanted, who will end up orphans, by accident, by both planned and random acts of violence, which are not problems either. Here in St. Cloud's, we would waste our limited energy and our limited imagination by regarding the sordid facts of life as if they were problems. Here in St. Cloud's, we have only one problem. His name is Homer Wells. We have been very successful with Homer. We have managed to make the orphanage his home. And that is the problem. If you try to give an institution of the state or of any government anything like the love one is meant to invest in a family, and if the institution is an orphanage and you succeed in giving it love, then you will create a monster, an orphanage that is not a way station to a better life, but an orphanage that is the first and last stop, and the only station the orphan will accept. There is no excuse for cruelty, but at an orphanage, perhaps we are obliged to withhold love. If you fail to withhold love at an orphanage, you will create an orphanage that no orphan will willingly leave. You will create a Homer Wells, a true orphan, because his only home will always be at St. Cloud's. God, or whoever, forgive me. I have made an orphan. His name is Homer Wells, and he will belong to St. Cloud's forever. By the time Homer was 12, he had the run of the place. He knew its stoves and its wood boxes, its fuse boxes, its linen closets, its laundry room, its kitchen, its corners where the cats slept, when the mail came, who got any, everyone's name, who was on what shift, where the mothers went to be shaved when they arrived, how long the mothers stayed, when, and with what necessary assistance, they left. He knew the bells. In fact, he rang them. He knew who the tutors were. He could recognize their style of walking from the train station when they were still 200 yards away. He was even known at the girls' division, although the very few girls older than he was frightened him, and he spent as little time there as he could, going only on errands for Dr. Larch, messages and delivering medicines. The director of the girls' division was not a doctor, so when the girls were sick, either they visited Dr. Larch at the hospital, or Larch went to the girls' division to visit them. The director of the girls' division was Boston Irish, and had worked for a while at the New England home for little wanderers. Her name was Mrs. Grogan, although she never mentioned Mr. Grogan, and no one seeing her would have an easy time imagining that there had ever been a man in her life. She may have preferred the sound of Mrs. to the sound of Miss. At the New England home for little wanderers, she had belonged to a society called God's Little Servants, which had given Dr. Larch pause. But Mrs. Grogan showed no signs of seeking members for such a society in St. Cloud's. Perhaps she was too busy. In addition to her duties as director of the girls' division, she was responsible for arranging what little education was available for the orphans. If there was an orphan who remained at St. Cloud's past the 6th grade level of school, there was no school to go to, and the only school for grades 1 through 6 was in 3 Mile Falls. This was only a 1-station stop on the train from St. Cloud's, but in 1930-something, the trains were often delayed, and the Thursday engineer was notorious for forgetting to stop at the St. Cloud's station. as if the sight of so many abandoned buildings convinced him that St. Cloud's was still a ghost town, or perhaps he disapproved of the women who got off the train there. The majority of the pupils in the one-room schoolhouse in Three Mile Falls